بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
We have a guest amongst us as one of our brothers, who lives in LA, and you might know him or have heard about him. He is the producer and director of many films and internet shows called Buzz Off, and he's doing a lot more work now and more excellent things, and he became Muslim, and he, or as he says, that he will always be Muslim, but he always worship God. So. And I want to just invite him so he can speak about what's on his mind and his thoughts and challenge here. This starts with us. Please welcome with a loud salam about Sean and his song.
Materialistic culture. There are only a few countries that actually maintain any resistance to this crass materialism, to this corporatism, that fundamentally, as we know, has always preyed upon the worst aspects of our being. The materialism that preys to our sexual appetites, that preys to our food appetites, to our worst tastes, that preys upon our desire for violence and revenge, that takes pleasure in people's pain and suffering, that's fascinated by the destruction as opposed to the creativity of man, to the uplifting of the human spirit. So, very few cultures are able to resist that, and yet what I saw in Islam consistently, and not just in Iran, I'll get to that in a moment, but here in the United States and friends that I had in Europe and Africa, was a consistent tendency of people to respect themselves. It has nothing to do with dress, because fundamentally a Muslim can wear the veil, choose not to wear the veil as a woman, and still fundamentally respect yourself. A man can partake in daily life in the Western world and still respect himself, because fundamentally he knows that God is within him at all times. He remembers God at all times. She remembers God at all times. Even in our sins, we recognize our weaknesses, but we don't have that same need as Muslims to seek reconciliation from a priest or from a church or from a hierarchy, because we already answer to God. That answer is immediate. And so when you see this in a culture that transcends borders, you realize there's a power to that, there's a force. And then going to a country like Iran, frankly, was refreshing. Iran is full of its own internal problems, and I'm not going to get into the political nature of it. And yet, at a moral level, it was refreshing not to be bombarded by billboards that tell you how to dress, that tell you as a woman how you should look, how you should behave. There is not this, again, you go back to the materialism, there's not this level of materialism being forced down your throat through advertising, through manipulation. Some would say that there's different forms of manipulation, but as far as the overall bombardment of the psyche and the lowest aspects of ourselves, Iran was free of it. There was a sense of family, there was a sense of history to the people. Because the people who have a history, they have a sense of honor to respecting that history. When you are close to your family, you're not going to dishonor yourself or prostitute yourself as readily, because you know that you answer to those parents, to the grandparents, to the tradition that brought you here. You have something that roots you. And as a result, there's a sense of honor that's integral to the people. And it's not just Iran, it's most of the Muslim world. And perhaps there are extremes. I'm reminded of a cartoon that I saw, which I think kind of encapsulates it very well. There's a cartoon of a woman who has a bikini on, white woman, bikini and sunglasses, standing next to a Saudi woman who's veiled except for her eyes. And the naked white woman says, "What a male chauvinistic culture, they make her cover everything except for her eyes." And the Saudi woman looks at the naked white woman and says, "What a male chauvinistic culture, they make her completely naked except for her eyes." So we have extremes in the world right now. And perhaps these are meant to remind us that we live amongst many illusions, many veils. But if the fundamental integrity can be maintained in your person, regardless of the physical conditions you live in, regardless of the physical reality that we inhabit, you you can maintain that sense of self-respect, then you'll preserve something that is dying in this Western world that we are having. The Western world is destroying itself. It's eating its youth, because it's prostituting its youth at the temple of Mammon, of money. And the prostitution is not just sexual, it's every level that we talk about, where people are forced to degrade themselves to make money. That is a curse. And so to remember God, to remember who you are, to remember your tradition, to remember your community, that is a tremendous blessing. And I think that is why, in my belief, there is such a tremendous war against Islam that comes from the West right now. Very few would admit it, because politically they cannot say that the war on terror is against Islam. But I believe that it has more to do with the nature of a morality that is predicated upon honor and duties and ethics that is an obstruction to the globalization of money, materialism, that can buy anything. If you cannot be bought, you are the greatest threat of all. And perhaps this is why the Shia world especially is under such attack. Can you see it from Somalia, which has a tremendous Shia tradition, going back to the Persian Empire? The older Persian Empire, I think it was the Abbasid, probably, if I'm not mistaken. But you can see it from Somalia to Syria to Pakistan, where Shia being indiscriminately killed, to Iran, which is still, in a sense, the heart, beating heart, living tradition of Shia Islam, comes to Iran, goes back to Iran. So perhaps this war against within the Muslim world, and we've seen an alliance largely between Saudi, certain Saudi sects, Wahhabis, for example, with the West, against Shia, because Shia perhaps are the memory of the Prophet and his family. Shia lies in memory of Ali and the Prophet's grandchildren. So you see, there's a tremendous war, and it won't be spoken of by the Americans or most Westerners, because they don't even know it. They don't know Islam enough to even understand it. And my understanding of Islam is not that of a scholar, but just a student who has traveled and seen things and learned. And so I would urge you to stay strong in your faith, because I do believe that God permits all things. God allows all things. There's a reason, inshallah, there is a much greater plan at work. And we must stay true in our faith. Stay strong in that, because the resistance sooner or later will prevail. Sooner or later there is a shift. All satanic times cannot go on forever. The Roman Empire did not survive. The Americans and the British and their empire will not survive if they maintain this course. It's the same path we've seen over and over again. So with that memory, with that tradition, I think we can go forward and have faith that there will be a new day where the honor that is in our hearts, the honor of respecting God, of having faith in God, that true faith, it cannot be destroyed. That will prevail.
I am the faith.
So with that, I would open it up to Q&A and discussions. Yes, ma'am. To give what?
Dawah.
Dawah?
No, I've been trying to invite
people to Islam. Oh, to come to Islam? I don't particularly see myself as someone who's actively seeking to
convert anyone, because for me, what I do, for example, with Buzzsaw, with our news network, it's about informing people. It's about trying to educate people. And I feel that the best way to bring people to your cause is to be a good example. And the more that, you know, I can show a modern image of Islam as a white American, I think that's the best thing I can do towards helping people understand it better and perhaps educating. And eventually, yes, I mean, ideally more people like Liam Neeson who've spoken about Islam with much respect, and, you know, he may be accepting Islam too. I'm not sure if he did or did not, but I think the point is that there are many conscious people who would accept it. There are many people, I think, in Hollywood especially, who fear acknowledging the fact that they are Muslim. I've heard this, you know, quite a bit because of, I mean, it's very unfortunate that there is an idea that Islam and Judaism are at war. And frankly, I think this is a myth, you know, that because Israel's existence means that every Muslim must hate Jews, it's nonsense. We may be ideologically or politically opposed to Zionism certain aspects of Zionism, but I do not think that that in any way means that Muslims and Jews, who have historically gotten along in this region and historically respected each other, going back to the constitution of Medina, the Prophet gave this respect to Jews to live and keep their worship inside Medina. You know, this is the true nature of Islam, is non-compulsion, right? So what we have, I think, is a polarity, and unfortunately, in Hollywood especially, there's obviously a large Jewish influence in the city, in the town, because of the filmmakers and executives and whatnot. But I don't think that should be looked at as a negative thing. If anything, I think as Muslims, we have to show the fact that we do respect Jews, we respect Christians, because they are all in the same lineage and they worship the same God. So in the end, whichever religion you end up practicing, if you end up going to hell as a result of it, that's not my business. Yes, sir.
Assalamu alaikum, brother. Alhamdulillah, thank you for coming and talking to us. I saw on Wikipedia that it mentioned that you were planning to make a documentary about jinns. I was curious, why you had interest in this topic, and is the documentary designed to appeal to Muslims and non-Muslims, or just the Muslim community?
That's a good question. Essentially, I've been interested by the jinn world for the last 3 years. I made a film called Greystone Park, which was largely inspired by events that had happened to me. My friend Alexander Raith, who's a Lebanese Shia, was my co-writer and co-star in the film. He took me to a mental hospital called Greystone in Jersey, and it's a real abandoned mental hospital, which is very haunted, spooky place. And as a result of the paranormal encounters that we had, I started learning about the jinn from him. And, you know, as a Lebanese kid, he had many stories, and, you know, there's folklore around the jinn. So when I went to Iran in 2011, I started inquiring as to if we could talk to certain scholars in Iran, because there's a lot of talk that politicians in Iran, for example, are communicating with jinn masters, people who communicate with jinns. And there seems to be some truth to it. It's a very touchy subject in the country that the political hierarchy doesn't seem to want to let most people approach that subject publicly. So as far as our documentary, you know, we're making interviews, we're getting footage. I've not been back to Iran in a year now, largely because of work here. So has not been my priority. It's more of a long-term documentary, as documentaries go. But ultimately, it would be fantastic, and we may ultimately make multiple documentaries. We make one documentary for a Farsi-speaking audience in Iran, and one documentary for an international audience. But that will be we'll see what the footage dictates ultimately, what we can get that's meaty, that's good. We'll see, you know, how to turn this into something that works. Yeah.
It's been my dream since I was young to be an actor and director for the purpose of enlightening people about Islam, specifically with the target audience of the American society. Do you have any advice for me or anything to offer? Or, you know, being a Muslim with, you know, Hollywood being predominantly Zionist, for the most part, do you have anything to offer for me if I do decide to, you know, pursue this career in the future, inshallah?
Being a filmmaker is not easy, no matter what your color or ethnicity or religion or ethnicity. It's a long journey of commitment, and, you know, as even Steven Spielberg would say now, it's ripe for an implosion. Hollywood is ripe for an implosion because of the nature of how they're contracting. The films are, the studios are making fewer and fewer films. They're making them more big, you know, global box office, tentpole pictures. So the nice thing is that you have access to, you know, to technology now with smaller cameras, cheaper cameras, lighting equipment that's getting more easier, more practical, that you can actually go and tell stories, make little movies. There was an interesting little film called Taqwa Corps about the Muslim punk rock band, for example. And, you know, I think that the point is that you can break in through the independent world as long as you find other like-minded filmmakers, friends, to work with you and just, you know, start to make something. Obviously, one constraint seems to have been the fact historically that when it comes to the Muslim world, there's not been that much support for filmmaking. For example, from Saudi Arabia or countries like this, they don't seem to be supporting filmmakers. But then you get countries like Iran where films are getting made, but at the same time, there's a lot of political censorship on it. You know, even when it comes to making Islamic movies, I know that you have a difficult time because you can't portray the Prophet, for example. You can't portray Ali and the grandchildren. I mean, the various imams, so it becomes very tricky, I think, with telling those historical stories. And yet, at the end of the day, I believe that because Islam is about, it's about moral choices, it's about ethics, it's about basic human principles, you can always translate a Muslim story into modern day life. You know, you can always find ways of making metaphors that are just, you know, are clever ways of telling a story that's very simple and yet touches the heart of people. And I think that's what filmmaking is about, and that's what it has to become again. It's about telling a story. We live in an age when the studios only want to make big spectacles full of visual effects that show off American firepower, military power, destruction, action, violence. And they've gotten very, very thin on story. So I believe that there is room to tap into, you know, smaller budget films and tell a story that touches people's hearts.
Assalamu alaikum. My question is kind of similar to what you just kind of touched on, but a little different. I have always, hoped and dreamed that someone would make a movie on Karbala with, like, the movie 300 kind of effects on it, you know what I mean? Like something, because the story of Karbala is so touching and it's so powerful, but it hasn't been depicted in a Hollywood standard kind of film. And I think the character of Imam Hussein is such a powerful character, but the world hasn't been introduced to it the way it should be. And I was just wondering, because, you seem like the guy that could do something like this. Have you ever considered it, knowing, that you can't show the faces and other things, but still, it's something that I feel needs to be done, and I was wondering if you ever thought about it.
Yeah, it's a bigger, the Karbala film would be a bigger venture, but I've definitely mapped out a way to tell it, and inshallah, eventually I'll be able to make that story in some way.
Assalamu alaikum.
Salaam.
My name is Dr. Shaheed from Los Angeles. What was one of the best things about Islam that attracted you or that brought you back to Islam? What was one of the most best qualities, if you will, that brought you to Islam that really came out to you?
That was essentially the nature of the whole speech, but I think if you could boil it down to one thing, I would say that I've always felt that there's in Christianity, people separate themselves from God as soon as they emphasize Isa, Jesus. And I've always looked at Jesus more as a kindred spirit. You know, he's someone who understood the word of God, conveyed it, but he was fundamentally a man. And so with Christianity, there's this divide, I find, between you and God, and it's like you have to look to Jesus and the sacrifice and then various priests. And in Judaism, it's a bit, again, it's an exclusive thing, not just based on bloodline, because I am part Jewish, but also this notion of chosen people to not even recognize your cousins, who are the children of, was it Isaac, right? Ishmael's son, not Isaac, yeah, exactly, the Jacob-Ishmael thing. So this is, to me, was so stupid. So with Islam, once it was clear that the relationship to God is direct and personal, and it's the nature of prayer, which is a very meditative, devotional practice, which how can you find something wrong with any religion that says pray five times a day? It's like you should pray constantly, in a sense. It's that relationship, that direct relationship to God, I found the most clear in my mind.
The brothers have been doing the questions. I think we should pass the mic over to the sisters, I think, if they have any questions first, before we continue with the brothers.
Yeah, you mentioned about Islam, and especially Shia Islam, there's so much concern about that.
What was the question?
Why there's so much concern about Shia Islam especially. You know, I have one brainstorming comment, that I think a ultimate objective of a Muslim, and especially a Shia, is the faith that we have only, we and our Imam, all the infallible, 14 infallibles, and everybody, all the prophets, Jesus, Moses, everybody, they have been created by only one Allah. And he's the one who has given all the blessings to not only us ordinary human beings, whether they are Muslims, Jews, or Christians, or Hindus, or whatever, Buddhists. He's the one who has blessed every human being with everything, all us human beings, no matter what. And he's the one who chose those prophets and the 14 infallibles, and also some of our scholars, and even us ordinary human beings. As we gain more knowledge, we increase our iman, and it goes up. And we have never considered ourselves anybody's slaves. It's very hard to subjugate us, because we never think that, okay, you get a job from us, that just lick your feet and then get a job from you. No, we believe that Allah is the one who created us, and he's the one who has sustained us. He's given us good brain to good education, and then get a good job, and also he arranged our upbringing through good parents and all that stuff. So I think we probably Muslims, and No, just don't object. So I just wanted to share my comment with you that we Muslims are, I think we are nobody's slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And we believe in Allah, whether we are in hard time, good times or hard times, and then we continue.
Yeah. Well, that's the Shia tradition is supposed to be the defenders of the repressed and the oppressed. That's I think, the way that they are looked at, and rightfully so.
Oh, there. Hi, assalamu alaikum. My name is Zara. I was just wondering what your reactions from your friends and family and coworkers was like to your conversion to Islam.
I think, like, I mean, initially, obviously, it was like the shot heard around the world. It was pretty intense as far as the shock that people had. And I think that just goes to show the overall Islamophobia that exists in the West. I've never felt antagonized personally as a result of it. I've heard there are people that hate me as a result, and I've seen posts on comments on all kinds of websites, you know, that would paint me to be a terrorist or something. But in my personal life, either people accept it. I mean, there are some, I think, that have yet to even realize that what I've done. They just think I'm a rebel. So they accept me as a rebel, and they're like, okay, well, he's crazy enough to go and do that. But no, I mean, fundamentally, I just feel that there's a tremendous fear of Islam at least in this country. I'm not sure about Europe. I know, you know, the Europeans are dealing with a lot of immigration from North Africa, from Turkey, so there's a lot of antagonism that exists more from immigration policies. But in America, it amazes me that the stereotype of Islam is usually predicated upon ignorance. It's an overall, the overall attitude is, oh, they degrade women. Women are abused, women are mistreated. And, you know, all you can do is try to get them to actually argue what they mean, because if you go from Saudi Arabia, I mean, I would agree that women not being able to drive or having no rights is an abuse, but you can't say that that's what Islam is either. So you can always find these people have plenty of logical inconsistencies, or it's almost, how do you say, they literally just don't, they cannot grasp what Islam actually means unless they've traveled there. And that's the amazing thing that I found talking to people who have actually been to the Muslim world, having been to the Middle East, and especially women, how much they really appreciate the way that they were treated, the way that they actually appreciate the respect that men, that Muslim men had for them, for example. And those people are always very actually interested and curious to know why, and actually, you know, respectful of the decision. Whereas those who haven't been to that part of the world, who don't really know what Islam means, are the most fearful.
Is that, assalamu alaikum. If you don't mind answering, can you tell us about your experience in Iran, and was it how you imagined it to be?
Iran is a unique place because, as I said, it's very much, it's one of the last countries that's off the grid. I mean, you could say, I would say Cuba, Iran, Somalia to a certain extent, Sudan, and I haven't been to North Korea, but I bet North Korea is like that. They're just not yet under the influence of Western culture. I have a respect for that. I have respect for the nation state. I have respect for their self-sovereignty, you know. And having been to the place, it's a normal functioning country. I think, you know, they have a lot of issues with inflation now because of the currency war. They have all kinds of, you know, they're under constant pressure and attack. But fundamentally, everything happens there that happens here, that happens everywhere in the world. It's just that I think in Iran there's this decorum as to what's public and what is private. And, you know, I guess I don't personally like the morality police. I don't like the nature of the, you know, any kind of Orwellian police force that can arrest you for, you know, for dressing the wrong way, for example, or, you know, saying the wrong thing. But you know, it's all changing. I think it's just a question of change. It's just a question of time. You know, the same way that Soviet Russia ultimately transformed into modern Russia, there are certain traditions that are Russian by nature that have to do with a very strong state, that have to do with a hierarchy, and that's thousands of years old. So I don't think that Iran will stay in this state, let's say, of isolation or of complete religious control forever. But at the moment, you know, I respect their laws, I respect, you know, I work within their culture, and it's, you know, it's a longer discussion. I think it's difficult to just give my impression in like a very short time, because there's a lot of contradiction inside the country. Let's put it like this. They have 16 clocks at the airport and not one of them is on time. So, they're not even all off on the same time. They're all off on different 5 minutes, 2 minutes, one stopped. Uh-huh. That's Iran for you. Yeah, they're off on Iranian time.
Assalamu alaikum. I have a question. What can we do as people who are here today listening to you and your experiences that you had as Muslims, as Shia Muslims, and how we can, as individuals, change people's perceptions about Islam and make them more friendly towards Islam and to combat Islamophobia in our daily interactions with people?
How to make them more open and understanding of Islam?
Yeah, like take home, what can we take home and start doing different?
I mean, you know, I guess it depends on who you're talking to. You know, if you're talking to a redneck, it might be a little bit different than if you're talking to a college graduate. But, you know, I don't know, you know, what you do for a living. I think it just depends on what your level is of engagement. I mean, if you're Muslim and you're only engaging inside of a Muslim community, then, you know, it would be like a black person in the South in 1950 trying to explain to white people that, you know, we're not all bad. You know, it's truly, you have to understand that there's, as long as you keep yourself separated and isolated from that culture, there's going to be a paranoia and fear. The more you engage with the rest of society just as a normal person, you build friendships, you create relationships. I think that just naturally comes. The whole problem of fear is usually based in isolation, being an outsider, fear of that which is unknown. So, you know, again, the South, I think, is a great example because, you know, as we know, black people, Latino people, all different ethnicities are integrated pretty well into cities. There's, you know, there may be levels of racism, but it's nothing compared to what it would be in the South when you had segregated communities. And that's what we have to fight against, is segregation. We have to be able to interact across all borders, as far as, you know, culturally speaking.
We'll have time for one more question, so I'll hand it over to Sheikh Mujahid.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's an honor for you to be here to speak to us, alhamdulillah. My name is Mujahid Abdul Karim. And I work with the youth in Los Angeles, the Bloods and the Crips. 90-some% of my work was, I'm sure you might be aware of them. But anyway, in 1992, Allah blessed me to spearhead a peace movement, a truce, and they signed a truce in the masjid. And Danny Glover, Sidney Poitier, Harry Belafonte, Denzel Washington, Oprah Winfrey, all of them supported it. Because two other brothers that helped me to get it organized, she invited them to come to her show to announce to the world about this peace movement amongst the youth in Los Angeles. And documentaries were made. I was in one, which I don't particularly care to be. But producer was working with Steven Spielberg, you know, on this one documentary about the peace movement in Los Angeles, because it spread it all over America. When it happened in our masjid, I've been working with them since 1978. It took me 14 years to get them organized, but it's a powerful movement. And alhamdulillah, some became Sunni Muslims, some became Shia Muslims. So even though Oprah Winfrey, Denzel Washington, they all came to watch, even Jerry Brown, the governor of California, he came to watch, and I was there with him when he came to support the truth, you know. And also one of the brothers that to help me get it organized that went to prison, he went to the prison to visit him, you know. So it would be very, I think, beneficial that a true documentary be made or a film on this peace movement, because just 2 weeks ago was a big summit meeting in Cleveland, Ohio, amongst the gangster disciples, the vice lords, the cobras, all of the major, you know, people. And it was positive because they trying to push this peace movement across America, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
So, inshallah, if you're interested, you can talk to me, because the Shiite were the ones that played the key role in getting these young guys mobilized to get this truth mobilized and spread it across America.
Well, you know, it's interesting because one of my mentors, in a sense, when I was in high school, was a man named Bo Taylor. He passed away a few years ago, but I actually worked for his organization called Unity One under AmeriCAN, which is Jim Brown's foundation. And Bo was a Muslim who had accepted Islam, I believe, after sometime during his work with the Navy or thereafter. But he was actually one of my mentors, because he did a program called Unity One, which was about gang prevention. And we would do this curriculum where we'd teach in Watts, in one of the high schools in Watts, in the prisons, in various community centers around South Central, Midtown LA. It was a tremendous program, community-oriented, around bringing people together and doing this kind of group-based discussion and letting guys, girls interact with a curriculum that allowed them to open up, that allowed them to express their feelings, that allowed them to talk without fear of being judged, because so much of the conditions of life within the communities is, you know, the reason kids go to gangs is that they're looking for identity. They're looking to identify themselves, and without a very strong family structure, without a very strong community structure backing them, they look to the gang to become their family. And so then they look to the identification, the identity of the gang, instead of their own individual identity. And whatever the gang needs, then they have to become. They have to become ethically and morally, you know, what is necessary for their gang to survive, to compete, whether it be within the drug traffic or within, you know, other criminal activities, banging, whatever. So the point was that this this culture kept mixing, going from the community, from the, especially with so many black youth being imprisoned, going from the communities to the prisons. The gang culture would thrive in the prison, come back out to the community, and it's without any kind of social structure to break that cycle. There's no way for this peace to come about. And I think that, you know, religion like Islam is practical, but I don't think it just stops with religion, because I think, of course, you know, Christianity, Islam, there's plenty of Christians too in the communities, but the point is that we have to get in there and actually educate these people and put them into groups where they can discuss and openly voice their opinions, because, you know, for the most part, they're socialized to not realize that it's okay to, as a man, for example, to show weakness, as a man to admit weakness, as a man to admit flaws. And that's the nature, that's the beauty of religion, is to be humble, right? To be able to humble ourselves, to say, you know, when we're wrong, to admit when we are weak, when we have to resort to God for our strength. And that, I think that level of understanding will help bring peace in these communities. And we, as we know, Chicago and places like this, which are being just being destroyed because of the gang warfare, you know, we definitely have to do something. So I'm all for it. I still support Unity One, and yeah, I'd be happy to help.
I know Unity One from there, but I can put you in touch with your
team. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Keep
you. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Good.
Friends, brothers and sisters, let's say a loud salawat for Shan Ali for being here with us.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
And we really thank him. He took some time off from his work, you know, to come over here. And even though we're local, you know, he's local here.
An hour.
An hour local, you know. But I said an hour in LA is like, you know, very short drive, you know. I've been here a week and I'm already tired of driving. But yes, you know, it's been a great pleasure having him here and sharing his thoughts with all of us. And inshallah, you know, we ask Allah to give him more tawfiq and bless him more, inshallah, and inshallah, make him a great example for all his peers in Los Angeles and especially in his work field, and inshallah, make him a means for Islam to grow in America. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad for him. And on behalf of Muslim Congress, inshallah, we just want to give this small token of appreciation, which is a plaque, and inshallah, it'll go in your trophy room, you know. You can put it over there. Thank you very much again. Thank you very much. Send a salawat for him.